This is the TechNet, which meets most Sunday evenings at 8 o'clock until 12. Once every 2 or 3 years, there's an interruption like there was last week. The main purpose of the TechNet, as you guys have heard so often, is education. The curious radio amateurs get together and talk to each other about wireless technology, how to transmitters and receivers and antennas and propagation. How does all this stuff work? The 26 different kinds of ham radio get discussed. The TechNet is broken up into approximately 3 sections. Let me drop. The first section is where people sign in because they do have a question or a comment. So they give us their call letters and their name after waiting for the 3 beeps, and try not to override the 3 beeps, otherwise you might get timed out. That's followed by the second section, which is Dr. Roy, AC2GS, with his science talk. And space, I think he's also going to have something called the space talk tonight, space items. But, and that's followed by Paul WS2N with the space report. If you guys, let me drop. Between 6 o'clock and 7 o'clock, if you watch the program called 60 Minutes tonight, 7 o'clock and 8 o'clock, 60 Minutes, the second section of 60 Minutes was a very nice presentation, an update on what the Voyager spacecraft is doing. It's out there 12 billion miles, and it's got this record, copper-plated, gold-plated record that's on the side with all kinds of information about the planet Earth. So that some extraterrestrial can get a lot of introduction of what Earth is like, done by Carl Sagan's wife, who wasn't his wife at the time that record was formed. That's how they met, in fact. So Voyager is by far the fastest, furthest, longest living piece of electronics that NASA has ever issued. 40-some-odd years later, thing launched in 1977. I think that makes it 41 years. Or something like that. Here it is, still telling us what the conditions are like out there beyond the solar system. So, very nicely done. Paul will probably also indicate to us, let me drop, that NASA has some nice websites where you can read about Voyager. It's being powered by a nuclear power supply. After 40-some-odd years, the thing can still aim its antenna. Its antenna has a something like 6/10 of a degree of beam width. And if that very high gain antenna, 36 or so dB of gain, if that's not aimed directly at the Earth, we hear nothing. So 40 some odd years later, the thing can still accurately aim its pencil beam antenna to the nearest a couple of tenths of a degree in azimuth and elevation, aim it back at Earth, and send down that roughly 10 watt signal, which takes the signal 18 hours at the speed of light to get here one way, 17 and a fraction hours. 36 or 37 hours round trip. Let me drop. If you talked on the RF uplink to Voyager, and you said, hello, Voyager, and if it answered you immediately, at the speed of light, your answer would come back 37 hours later. What a piece of electronics. Okay, let me drop. We're going to take sign-ins at this time. Try not to talk on top of each other. You're going to give me your call letters and your name, and the word yes, meaning you do have a question or a comment. You need not sign in just because you're listening and you're supporting the net. Thank you for doing that, but not required. After 36 years, we believe somebody is listening. This may be one of those longest living nets under one leadership. We believe that's a record. Okay. Give me a call letter and name right now if you've got a question or a comment. K2RIW listening.
And we are ready for the comment.
WH4YY, Joe, yes.
JB2BBN, yes, yes, yes.
Okay. So we've got Rich, Joe, and Freddie in that order. Anyone else? Give me a call letter and name right now.
It's K2GJE. What happened to over-the-air 55? Over.
It's on RF 27. Do a rescan.
RAF with a question.
Did you hear that answer? It's on RF 27, do a rescan.
Got you loud and clear.
KD2, PPF, Papa, Papa Foxtrot, question mark. What is your name, sir?
Their name is Matt in New Rochelle, New York.
Okay, we got Matt. And Ed probably had his question answered. So we've got Rich, Joe, Freddie, and Matt. One last call. Anyone else with a question or a comment for the TechNet? Give me your call letters and name right now.
KD2, QPVO, this is Andrew. Question about the antennas.
Okay. It sounded like Kilo Delta 2, Quebec Papa Victor, question mark. And I think you said your name is Kendu. Please correct me on your call letters phonetically. Go right ahead, sir.
Kilo Delta 2, Quebec Bravo Oscar.
Quebec Bravo Oscar. Okay. All right, we're going to go over to Rich first with his comment. N2EO, K2RIW, go ahead, Rich.
Okay, Dick, thank you. I have a Bearcat. Now it's actually called Uniton. The model number is a HP-435 scanner. And it's a great scanner, but there were problems because of no service data. The company Uniton does not release at all a manual, nothing. You get a user's manual, but nothing if something goes wrong. Let me go reset. There's a backup battery for some of the memory. And they say that the battery should last 10 years. It does not. I looked on the internet, many people are having the same problem as I am, where the battery goes dead in less than a year. It took me a lot of research. I got the number of the battery. I had to buy it on eBay because there was another dealer but that sold lots of 1,000. I got 5 batteries from China for, with shipping, $15. But I still didn't know where it went. G-Unit KJI Electronics thought it went on the main board. It does not. When I go today, just today, months later, reference radio.com shows a close-up of the board. It's behind the front panel, about the center. It's a good picture in color, and he has it, the battery circled in orange. So I will try putting it in tonight or tomorrow, being that I know where it is. Bearcat makes, or Uniton makes good stuff, but the technical support, terrible. Back to that.
Sounds like a good deal of research on your part there, Rich, to find that all out. And that battery maybe has tabs on it. Maybe it's a mercury or one of those watch coin-type batteries. I'm guessing what it might be. And hopefully that battery is only there for the backup memory for the frequencies that you're storing. Hopefully it's not the main microprocessor program. There was a period of time in the mid-70s when you lost the battery, you lost the computer program, you had to send it back to the factory to be reprogrammed. Hopefully, sounds to me like you've been through this battery replacement once before, and you only lose your stored frequencies, and you have to re-put them back in. Is that roughly true, Rich? N2EO, K2RIW.
No, it's an odd battery. It's very tiny, and it is rechargeable lithium battery. So, I want the memory, but once the battery's in, I can reprogram it. Jane Dawn at KJI, that had to be soldered. It does not. It looks like just a clip you have to pop it into. So what I have to do tonight and tomorrow is loosen the front panel, tilt it down, and the battery is right there.
Yeah, I've done a similar repair on my Kenwood 432 all-mode rig, which I can't think of the model number now, 751 or something like that. And when you loosen that front panel to get to the electronic behind it, try your darndest to use very good electrostatic discharge practices. In other words, make sure your body is well grounded to the chassis of the rig, because you put the smallest amount of static charge into the electronics, and you can drive the microprocessor crazy. So be careful with just anything you touch in there. Make sure you're grounded to the chassis of the rig when you're doing that work, Rich. Let us know how that turns out. N2EO for any final comments, K2IW.
Stick, I'm gonna do it tonight or tomorrow, but I'm really upset with Uniden. They don't make any information available. I had to do it on my own. GW2KJI helped me some of it. Hit it for Pike's show.
Yeah, when it comes to ICOM, it's beautiful at supplying raw parts and you order parts from ICOM, and they'll mail it to you and mail you a bill. They trust you to pay them back later on. Kenwood, it's very difficult to get parts for a Kenwood rig. It looks like Uniden is also making things difficult. And it's short-sighted on their part. They should realize that ham radio operators talk to each other and relay all of their horror stories. Next person on our list was Joe, W2RYY. How are those electrons treating you these days? And I know you're in the heavy repair of that garage door opener. Good luck on that one. Over to you, Joe, K2RYW in the TechNet.
Well, this is WHYY, and in the case of those electrons in that project, did not treat me so well. I sent you a bunch of pictures. Were you able to understand each of the pictures I sent you before we go any further?
By your descriptions, I know what they were describing. If you're asking me, did I interpret the kinds of modulation that were on the oscilloscope pictures, and what is the real raw modulation for the transmitter to talk to the receiver? No, I didn't get a hell of a lot out of that. And for you to trace without a schematic diagram to try to trace the printed circuit board and figure out what's going on, I know you've got a heavy challenge there. You might want to mention to people what's the model number of your garage door opener, which I think you said is like 30 some odd years old, which probably means that it went out of date a decade ago, Joe. And so it's a heroic effort on your part to bring that back to life. W2RYY, K2RYW on the TechNet.
Went out more than a decade. Try about 2.5 decades. That thing was made from early 80s to 1992. It's an SP229 garage door opener made by GE Company. They don't make any more. Parts are extremely hard to get to the darn thing. But my question is really in simplicity. I've never seen a receiver, and I knew this thing put out this kind of energy because I picked it up on my TV antenna when I scanned the TV antenna bands, the different going across the bands with the spectrum analyzer. Right, one day I discovered that this thing was producing that kind of energy, and it looks like broadband noise. What I don't understand is how can a receiver work if it's putting out noise across the frequency it wants to receive? That's something of a mystery, which I don't quite understand, because I look for the local oscillator frequency of this receiver, trying to figure, maybe trying to derive the IF possibly and find out if the LO is off frequency or not. I can't even see that with those pictures I sent you. That's what I have to work with. What kind of receiver do you think this is?
If I had to make a guess, I'm guessing this is OOK. In other words, on-off keying. The on-off keying rate probably is not very well synchronized. On-off keying makes noise like sidebands all over the place. It looks like Bart's head haircut on a spectrum analyzer picture. So it looks like noise. On-off keying with some kind of a random code built into it. And until you synchronize it just right and, on an oscilloscope, the picture won't sit still during the time you're transmitting. That's a guess on my part. So it looks like noise is smeared across the screen, but if the receiver is looking for that on-off keying, it finds that signal in that noise, so to speak. It's a kind of direct sequence spread spectrum is one way of looking at it. Any direct sequence spread spectrum signal looks like noise, but to the receiver that's properly synchronized, that's not noise at all. It's very coherent. That's a bunch of guesses on my part, Joe. So, General Electric, garage door opener, FB229. Let's hope that somebody knows something about that. I presume you've already done some search on the internet. It probably was popular at one time. There's always internet guys out there repairing things like that, and if you can find one of those websites, I bet you that would be helpful. To B2RYY, T2RIW, and the Tech Man.
Alpha Charlie 2, November X-ray, I have an answer.
The garage was made by Genie, not General Electric. Now, Dick, I'll pick up the other guy in a moment, or I'll turn over to him. Do you also notice the picture of the transmitter, or the handheld remote, of what kind of pattern that put out by itself? What would you think that is?
Oh, no. Alpha Charlie 2, November X-ray. Please start off with your name, sir, and then your information. We're looking forward to it.
Alpha Charlie 2, November X-ray. Name here is George. I am on the Long Island Expressway on my way home back to New Jersey. Regarding the question about the spread spectrum, you were correct in that presumption about it. Typically what they do is modulate the signal onto a pseudo-random noise signal, which usually ends up being a digital signal. And as you pointed out, it does have to be coherently decoded at the receiver as well. It's similar to the encryption that we do when we're sending encrypted messages. And as long as the receiving end has the key and is properly synchronized, then it can pull the signal out of the noise. In fact, that's the way that the signal comes back from the Voyager that you were talking about. AC2NX, back to net.
I thank you, George. So it does sound like it is a kind of direct sequence spread spectrum type transmitting signal, and the individual code of the spread spectrum of the transmitter, that's what allows you to select garage door opener number one versus your neighbor. I think Joe did have at times a neighbor bought the exact same garage door opener a block away, and occasionally the neighbors would open Joe's garage door. So I presume each individual transmitter-receiver pair has a particular, I'm going to guess, 5 or 6 bit code for that's supposedly addressing only that one receiver. It's a bunch of guesses on my part, George. AC2, November X-ray, K2RIW on the TechNet. My name is Dick.
The remote and the garage remote have 12 pins. You can either make high or low. If you punch out a pin, it makes that pin going into the chip high. If it's shorted, it goes low. So they do match. I was able to at least take a VOM and verify that. So the code didn't change as far as what I'm sending, at least as far as the pattern. But as far as me actually measuring the digital information, there's no way for me to do that. So I can't really tell if my receiver's bad or I have a bad sender.
Very fine, Joe. Let's see if George has any further information on, is that a 12-bit code? If so, that's an amazing number of permutations and possibilities there. Alpha Charlie 2, November X-ray, mobile, K2RIW, go ahead, George, for any further info.
K2RIW, AC2NX. Yeah, that 12-bit code that he's talking about probably is the seed that gets planted into both the transmitter and the receiver. But then there is a usually a shift register with feedback that's defined by those 12 bits, and it defines a much longer sequence of codes that come out of the thing. Probably something 2 to the 12 is a number of bits before the thing repeats itself. But in any event, that 12 bits would be the thing that gives it its personality. And it's sort of like, you know, the little tabs on your key so that it matches up with the lock. So that piece of information would be correct. As far as being able to test that to see what the thing is doing right, you would literally have to have a test set that measures exactly what that thing is doing so that you can read the code. And the details of that could vary from manufacturer to manufacturer and from implementation to implementation. That's the best I have to offer for that. AC2NX back to net.
George, with 12 bits that can be set, that's 4,096 possibilities. That strikes me as more than enough for individual garage doors being programmed, so the chances of you and your neighbor having the same code is very low. You made it sound like the 12 bits is only a seed that goes into a more elaborate code yet. And does that code change day to day or pressing to pressing? Why isn't the 12 bits the exact code that's used on every transmission then, George? AC2 November X-ray, K2RIW.
K2RIW, AC2NX. As I said, what that 12 bits does is define the feedback around a shift register that has selective taps on it. Those taps can be in odd places, and I would imagine that what that thing does is determine whether or not there is an inversion at each one of those feedback points, so it changes the sequence. Now, you're right, you would have 2 to the 12 possible combinations of, number one, of different codes that you could have, assuming, that many codes, but some of those may be part of the redundancy that helps the thing have some noise immunity as well. So there may be some smaller amount of numbers that you can accommodate. But as you said, that's plenty, certainly, to discriminate one neighbor from the next. But in terms of the code that is generated, it is this the shift register. I can recall one time having a pseudo noise generator that had probably about 17 stages of shift register, maybe about 6 or 8 feedback points, and that thing would just sit there and churn out a signal that when you listened to it sounded just like white noise, but when you looked at it, eventually you could hear a repeat, and in fact, if you trained on it for a while, you could actually get to recognize the pattern that was coming out. So it is coherent, but it's coherent with a very, very complex pattern of bit train that's coming out of it. AC2NX back to net.
Very good information. I thank you, George. Do you have any suggestions as to what Joe can do to do further troubleshooting? My first suggestion would be to make sure that the transmitter is putting out a reasonable amount of power. I'm guessing that a reasonable amount of power for a garage door opener to have enough range is something like 5 milliwatts, so to speak. Other than that, what testing can he do to confirm is his lack of communication transmitter-related or receiver-related? Any guesses on this one, Joe? George, AC2GS, here we go. AC2 November X-ray, K2RIW, I got it, George.
K2RIW, AC2NX. Yeah, certainly he's not going to be able to troubleshoot the decoder without more specific information about that. However, the receiver probably does have front-end stage converters and all that sort of thing. Depending upon what the modulation format, you know, it could be a phase shift keying kind of a thing. It could be some quadrature amplitude modulation, a number of different combinations of that. But that would be kind of immaterial. I mean, you may be able to learn how to recognize that if you look at the thing on a scope. But in any event, you can at least check to see whether or not you're getting signal through the various stages of the receiver, assuming that you can either get a schematic of it or extract something from that. AC2NX, back to net.
As I understand it, Joe is operating without a schematic at this time. For him to trace the transmitter and receiver and come up with his own schematic, I've done that on occasion, and that's not an easy job. And when it comes to phase shift keying, quadrature keying, that makes a much more complicated receiver with a vector demodulation. That would take a lot more... I think most of this is discrete components because of the year of manufacture. My guess is this is a relatively simple on-off keying of that code. OOK, they call that, on-off keying. So, good luck with this project, Joe, and back to you. W2RYY, K2RYW in the TechNet. Go ahead, Eric.
I've had my fun fixing garage door openers. Ones that I had from the 80s, they were operating at either 310 or 315 megahertz. The modulation scheme was basically FSK, and they used a pseudo-random number generator and a key, which was in the transmitter. You hit a button on the opener, and it would receive the key from that particular transmitter. And the pseudo-random number sequence would be sent back by the garage opener to the transmitter, and once that was married, it kind of looks like noise, but it's really FSK. The later ones that I understand are doing QPSK and 8PSK, so it's not sped spectrum in the sense that you're syncing sped spectrum, but it's very wide shift up, and it's real cheap and easy to do, and the only ones that I've ever played with, they all had PALs for creating the decode for decoding. It's essentially a long shift register, like the other gentleman was saying. K2RW, K2J.
Okay, you said they had PALs. You're going to tell us what PAL stands for. Also, to give us a hint, you've now fixed a number of failed garage door openers. What was the component of failure that you found in those cases, Eric? K2EJ, K2RW?
Now, I've only fixed two garage door openers in my life, so, you know, and then I'm looking at a specific manufacturer and their method of doing it, and it was in the mid-80s. PAL is a programmable logic chip. That was long before FPGAs and the kind of stuff that we deal with today, so it was basically a bunch of gates that you could configure however you wanted within the chip.
Okay, you've only fixed two of them. What was the failed component on those two? Might give him a hint. Go ahead, Eric.
The problem that I had was in the, making the transition from RF to data. It was basically what we today would consider a balanced modulator, a balanced demodulator, and wound up getting 90 degrees from one and the other, or an INQ decoder.
Okay, what was the failure? What kind of a... Was there a transistor you had to replace, Eric? Go ahead.
It was a chip. The chip was unmarked, but after looking at drawing it out on a piece of paper, we kind of figured out it was actually a 1494 or 1496 type chip.
And 1494 or 1496, when it fails, it no longer does its function that you can recognize, like ESD failure or just... Insufficient removal of the flow solder flux which ate into the chip. What's your guess as to what was failing there, Eric? Go ahead.
I can kind of tell you exactly. It's a, 1496 is a four quadrant multiplier. And when you look at a four quadrant multiplier, think of it like a balanced mixer. You have a single input with two outputs, and one of the outputs are missing. So, it's pretty obvious.
And what actually failed inside that chip, we don't know. But for you, it was a simple desolder, put a new one in, and then it ran. Was that the failure on both of the garage door openers that you repaired, Eric? Go ahead.
No, the other one that I fixed had a plus and minus power supply. The minus supply wasn't working, and it wound up being a Zener diode.
Understand. Okay, Back to you, Joe, for any filled requests or further questions. To B2RYY. Our garage door maven for the day. KQRIW. You got it, Joe?
Far from that. With the pictures I sent you, if you take a good look at it, you can see the PC side of the board, which does have 115 volts because they're switching the motor and probably changing the polarity of the motor one way or the other. There's 115 volts coming in there. The one thing I did notice is some traces that have little fingers on them, almost like they're arc over protection, if it's like a protection surge of some kind. And they didn't look like they were burned or, you know, something hit the circuit board or something like that. But from the pictorial side, component side, all you see on the receiver is two modules, a little silver module on one end with a wire sticking out of it. That's the receiver. And on the top, it just has a black module with some writing on it, MCC identification. And then there's one chip on the board that says 7008. Below that, it says SMC. And then I think 8749, which is probably the date code of the device itself. That's all you got. I tried looking up that number. That don't mean anything. Can't find it.
Could the 8749 be the 49th week of 1987? Is that the approximate possible date of manufacture? That's question number one. And I did see those whiskers you're talking about between the traces. I am guessing that that printed circuit board is used on multiple products. And sometimes they want some of those lands connected together. Sometimes they don't. Therefore, they cut away those traces that are narrow pieces of copper foil between. So they cut those away for that particular product. That's my guess. That being an arc over protector, I kind of doubt it. It would take too many kilovolts to do that. Over to you, Joe, K2RIW.
I figured the 8749 is the date code of the device itself. That I pretty much surmised. I've seen that on the other chips before. But I looked up the number 7008 SMC or SMC 7008. You can't find anything. There's nothing related. You find all sorts of other stuff, but not a chip. So if that thing was made, it's probably made. The information's long gone. It's extinct. So if that thing actually blew out, I'll probably never be able to get the thing replaced unless I find a board, somebody who's got a board sitting someplace. I did find a couple of remotes on eBay of the same kind I have, same series remote, and these things run at about 390 megahertz, and the handheld is only a transmitter. It only sends. It's all it does. And I was able to center the frequency to 390 megahertz because I could see that on my spectrum analyzer. And it's an adjustment on the side of the remote to put a hex tool in, turn the little tuning coil, and run the frequency back and forth.
Make a rough guess as to what power output you saw from that transmitter, Eric. I mean, Joe.
There's no way to determine that. You're holding in the spectrum analyzer. I can get the thing to go over minus 40 into a rubber antenna, like right near it, maybe minus 30. But that doesn't really mean anything. It doesn't matter. The remote doesn't trigger the device standing right next to the receiver wire. So power's not the issue.
Eric, 7008. That sounds like T squared L logic. Quad NAND gate or something like that. Was there once a chip 7008 KE2EJ,
K2REW? AC2NX.
I would say no, Dick. It sounds like a company code. I mean, you can take a traditional chip erase, you know, have it manufactured with your specific part number, and pick up the other station.
Go right ahead, George.
Repeater, timeout.
I was going to say, wait for the beep. AC2NX, go ahead, George, after the beep.
AC2NX, yeah, I was waiting for the beep. Yeah, TTL is 7400 series. CMOS, at least the stuff of that vintage, was 4000 series. 7,000 sounds to me like it may very well have been the particular project code for that programmable logic device that they did for the decoder. But the odds are the decoder is not going to be the problem. And if he's saying that he can't get the thing to center around 390 megahertz like it should be, you know, maybe he's got a cracked core in his tuner or something like that so that the thing isn't able to reach the frequency that he's after.
And that goes back to my original question, Dick. How do I determine the frequency of what those things does is put out a broadband noise? How do I know what the center frequency is? I even moved the remote down as low as 360 megahertz, which pretty much almost matched the frequency I saw out of this receiver. The energy, it still didn't matter, still didn't work. I moved it up the other way up to about 410 megahertz, still didn't work.
Yeah, I have a clue for you. There's an FCC ID number on it. You can actually find out what frequency it's set for. There are a number of guard door frequencies in there, fixed, so it's going to be one of them. I think there's like six or seven of them.
Yeah, I have the FCC number, and it's a 390 megahertz remote.
And okay, so the FCC number tells you it's on 390 megs, 390, 392, something in that order. Were you able to get both transmitter and receiver appear to be operating at 390 on your spectrum analyzer? Over to you, Joe. Wait for the beep.
No. The sender does not activate the receiver. It doesn't make the garage door work. The garage door works only when you push the button in the house or in the garage door locally. Those local buttons work okay, and the thing goes up and down mechanically and operates fine. So part of the board is working. The receiving part that causes that to do that is not working. You can't change the frequency on the receiver. I don't know how. As I said, if you took a look at the pictures I sent you, there's a silver module with an antenna wire near it. That must be the receiver module. And then there's another black module that has the FCC ID number and something else that says AR90-1, and like a black cube. I have no idea what's in that black cube or the receiver module. There's not that many pins that come through on the PC board, so it's some sort of modularized device.
W2OSR.
OSR, go ahead, Bob.
I just pulled up a data ship on an data sheet on an IC7008, and I think that's what he was looking for.
Tell us about that.
Says it's a high-speed 64K by 8 dual-port static RAM.
That data sheet you're reading is what brand name, Bob?
IDT.
How many pins does the chip have on it?
Hang on a second, I gotta get down to the form factor.
Dick, if you look at the picture, there is a trimmer, a small ceramic trimmer cap that must adjust some frequency that probably is a CPU frequency. I think that thing is some sort of CPU because you can look at it with the number of pins it has on it. It's not just a logic array. It's something a lot more complex inside that chip. One side has the pins that feed it from the code, which is basically a ground or an open. So it has either 12 volts or a ground on some selection of pins, like 12 pins. But as you can see, that thing's got like at least 24 or 28 pins, totally.
All right, I may not have the same device. What I'm looking at has 84 pins on it.
That sounds very different. Let me drop it. Now, you still haven't answered my question, Joe. My question was, when you're looking at your spectrum analyzer, and you know the thing's supposed to be on 390 megacycles, did your spectrum analyzer show that what energy is coming out of that transmitter was approximately 390? Over to you, Joe.
Yes, Dick, I said that already. I was able to not only put the thing right on 390 megahertz at the peak energy, because I gave you two different displays, like a wide display and a narrow display at 10, like 100 kilohertz per division, or 1 mega. 1 mega looks like a pinpoint with a bunch of energy that flows off on either side of the transmitter frequency, like, looks like sideband energy. Yes, I can move that spike up and down as high as 410 and as low as about 350. Didn't make any difference whatsoever.
Yeah. And I think you said you also saw RF energy coming out of the receiver, and that the silver package probably is a shielded can over top of the receiver function to shield it from the rest of the circuitry. And it's probably a way of removing that can to see what's going on inside. So, did the receiver also be showing some RF energy near 390? because maybe it is a zero IF receiver system. W2RYY, K2RIW, wait for the beeps.
I think he looked at all the pictures. I thought I sent him numbered each one as far as, and I told his description what the picture was, what the setting was on the analyzer. When you hold the RF probe from the service monitor, you take a rubber antenna and a piece of cable, as I'll put propping up on a ladder so it wouldn't drop my service monitor. All you see is this wide band noise occupying from about maybe 320, 330 up to almost 400. But it peaks about 350 as far as 350 megahertz. That's where I was looking for the local oscillator on this board, and I don't see it. I just see broadband noise across a very wide band of frequencies. And I see it peak at about 350 megahertz, but I can't see an LO. But there is a tape over covering a hole on that receiver module, and there's also an adjustable trimmer next to the multi-legged chip that's on the board. I didn't touch either one.
And don't.
Okay, without a service manual, I wouldn't.
And you guys got any further suggestions for Joe as to what's the next step in troubleshooting his late 80s garage door opener? K2RIW listening, wait for the beeps. Yeah, that looks like all the help we're going to get tonight, Joe. You may be down to tracing out the lands and making your own schematic diagram. I know that's a pain in the neck. I've had to do that on a couple of things that I own where you can't get a schematic. You have to generate your own. But you may be forced to do that and then study that schematic and ship it to various people. Over to you, Joe. W2RYY, K2RIW.
AC2NX.
Hopefully, Dick, the next guy's question will be much, much simpler.
Go ahead, George.
AC2NX here. Yeah, the main suggestion that I would have is, you know, given that he's got that receiver module in there and he has a place to get at the input and get at the output of the thing, just get a signal generator and you know, probably the tracking generator on your spectrum analyzer, and just see where you get an output from that thing when you're sweeping a signal into the input of that thing, and just see what the receiver itself is doing and whether or not it's working. I mean, if you've got noise when you're putting a pure carrier in the darn thing, then you know you got something going on in that receiver that shouldn't be happening. AC2NX, back to net.
Well, let me tell you the difficulties in trying to even take simple measurements of this thing. The wiring is attached to the garage door opener, so the board is now dangling below the garage door opener, and that's where I have to, you know, I can't take this sort of thing and put it in my house to work on it. I got to work on it off the, you know, with this board suspended from the garage, from the wiring of this remote. I took the cover off it. So I don't have a lot to play with. It's very hard to hold the thing with one hand and try to trace, you know, something else with something else like a scope probe or whatever. You got nothing to lay the board on and work on it. I just don't have that kind of environment to work with this thing. And I certainly can't take the garage door off where it's mounted and try to bring it inside powered up. That would make a total mess.
One of the most basic things to check in a case like this, which you've probably already done, the garage door opener, I'm guessing, runs from 110 volts. Somewhere in there is a rectifier, power supply, regulator. Are you fairly sure that the B-plus being applied to that board is approximately the right number of volts and reasonable purity, not oscillating and not jumping around and chopping out of a 60-cycle rate? Do you believe the power supply on the receiver board is getting clean input DC voltage, Joe? Over to you, Joe, K2RIW.
Reasonably sure about that. There's three different voltages. I think I emailed you and I said I found two of them. As I explored a little more, I found a third one. There's actually a chip that takes 110 volts, it takes voltage out of the transformer, which is being stepped down, obviously, to some point. It goes into a simple chip, AC in, DC out. That has about 35 volts of DC coming out of that chip. That has some ripple on it. Later on in the board, it goes down to about 18 volts DC. That has no ripple at that point. And most of the other points of the board where you have measurable voltage is somewhere around 12.7 volts. Again, very clean DC with no ripple that I can measure.
That's a good sign. And now with that PC board hanging up in the air on your garage door opener, to trace out that schematic diagram of the receiver, I know that's going to be a pain in the neck. But you might have to do that. And so right now we don't know if we've got a transmitter failure or a receiver failure. We know we've got a system failure. Over to you for any final comments, Joe. The B2RYY, KQIW.
Well, I was able to unplug the board and bring it inside and set it up on the table and take pictures and send them to you. So I can disconnect the board as a single plug that disconnects it from the entire opener. But once you disconnect it, it's not powered. I wouldn't try to put artificial power in the thing. I could destroy the thing that way. So I have the thing in its intended mode of operation. I mean, with all the wiring it goes to it. It's going to be a difficult problem. I'm not sure how to tackle this one. I'm going to try calling some numbers tomorrow and see if some places that I found that have parts for old garage door openers made by Genie, if anybody would have any spare or old receiver boards, that'd be one start. They can't cost too much because the things aren't made anymore, but who knows. I have found also another source for the handheld openers for about maybe $19. I think I spotted one or two of those on eBay. So that's another possibility too. Maybe my remote is on the right frequency, but it's not putting out the right coding. Something could have happened to the remote. But, you know, like I said, I have no way of reading that code energy. I couldn't possibly tell you if it's right or wrong. The only thing I can tell is that it's on the right frequency. And varying the frequency makes no difference.
You know, when I've ever looked at a remote, including a QRS remote from the car, it's a single frequency. It's just modulated.
Well, you can hear it. It sounds like AM modulation if you put the service monitor on AM. And that's what you can really hear. You don't hear it on FM, even FMY. You hear it more like it's an AM form of modulation being generated. But I couldn't tell if the thing is generating the right code or not. I wouldn't have any way of determining that.
DC2IS coming.
Go right ahead, Bill. And Bill, give us a lot more audio. You got it, Bill.
Is this better? Let me break for a moment for your report.
You went from 10% audio volume to now you've got 50% audio volume. But go right ahead, Bill. We're hearing you very clear.
Okay, that's interesting. I'm using the same setup as usual. But I'm wondering, I think I tuned into this a little bit late, but I'm thinking this is a garage door opener, so it should have a wired connection inside the garage so that you can push a button to open the garage door. And I'm wondering if there's an option that people have already discussed and discarded maybe for buying a new, not garage door opener, but the RF portion of it, and then just have something, you know, electronically push that button for you, or is that, you know, just not how you want the problem solved, AC2IS?
If I can't fix the remote operation problem, that's what I'm going to have to do. I have thought of that. I could simply parallel the wiring to the inside button or the outside button. Both buttons work. So mechanically, the garage door opener will open and close, and it does its thing by having this button closure. Yes, I could do that. I'd have to find something fairly cheap, reasonable, or whatever, that if you can find a remote that gives you, say, a contact closure output from some sort of generated remote, that would solve my problem. I'm trying to solve it by fixing the device at hand. If I can't do that because of its age, I'm going to have to look down that avenue. Thanks. Hey, go on.
Joe, when it comes to powering the receiver board in the house, that may not be as bad as you think. the 35 volts coming out of the one-stage rectifier off that transformer. Gets regulated down to 18. The other voltages, I am guessing, are regulators on that receiver PC board. So you may only have to feed one DC voltage into that board to power that up on your bench. Over to you, Joe, KQRW. Do wait for the beeps.
I don't have a working 35-volt supply of good quality. I have something, but it's not usable. Because it's 50 volts, but it's got all sorts of ripple on it. It wouldn't work for me. I don't have a way of doing that. So I don't think that's going to be the answer. I have to just take this one step at a time to see if I can find a replacement board first, or if even something's available, and just assume that the receiver probably is bad. Because it's been working for a long time, and only recently it started becoming like it started treating the symptom like it was like lack of range, like I had to be right in the driveway itself to make the door operate correctly. I used to be able to do it from about maybe halfway down the block. I couldn't do that. It had to be like right on top of it to trigger it. Then it got to a point where now it doesn't do it. It doesn't receive at all. Maybe I have a receiver problem, but like I said, I tried the remote right next to the wire antenna, and it doesn't trigger it. So you know as much as I do right now about this problem. I got to take it one step at a time, I guess. Over to the next guy. I think you've exhausted this one quite a bit. I think it's about almost 8:55.
Okay, I'm at KC1 SAM.
SAM, go right ahead.
Yeah, thanks, Dick. Real quick comment. So they do make generic replacements, receivers and transmitters, and they hook right up, and they work by closing the contact like you would be pushing the button. I can't tell you how much they are, but I have seen them. And my other thought real quick is I suspect it's a transmitter only because of the extreme heat we had. You know, your receiver just sits there and does nothing. But that transmitter's been out in that extreme heat we had last week, and I wonder if there's some kind of physical heat damage, something was damaged by that. That's my only comment. KC1SAM, standing by.
Well, it could be a possibility. On the vehicle I'm using right now, I flip the thing on the visor so it stays on the inside of the visor. Whether that temperature on the inside of the visor coming through the roof, if the temperature can get that hot to destroy parts on this remote, I don't know if the thing is actually, that could be the problem. It actually gets hotter in the garage by itself because it has poor ventilation. That gets hotter much more easily than the inside of the car where it has a remote transmitter. The receiver actually, with the garage over it, that's in a probably a much warmer environment continuously.
Many cars sitting out in the sun with the windows rolled up in a parking lot, the inside temperature of the car goes to numbers like 180 degrees Fahrenheit. What makes that different in your case, Joe? Go ahead.
Because it's not 180 degrees when I get in the car. Yes, the car is parked in different spots as I go about throughout the day, but it's not 180 degrees. That's very, very high. Where'd you get that kind of number from?
Depending on the color of the car, the color of the upholstery, the windshield and whatever, there's a whole bunch of variables. But there have been various news reports of animals or children left in a car, and numbers of that altitude are sometimes quoted. Okay, we're going to move on to the next person. Who, let's see, was Freddie. Mr. BBN, I think it is. Freddie in Far Rockaway, go right ahead with your question. K2RIW in the TechNet.
This is KB2 VBN.
KB2 VBN, who checked in with a question or a comment. K2RIW, you've got it, Freddie.
Yes, I was watching the 60 Minutes show about the Voyager, and they mentioned the spaceship is moving at 38,000 miles per hour. Is that true? Does the thing go that fast?
Yeah, I don't blame you for being skeptical, Freddie. To be that far away, moving that fast on pure rocket power, is way beyond what we've got the capability of doing. However, once every 170 or 190 years, the planets line up in such a way that when you do a flyby of Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune, they did a flyby of three or four planets, and you pick up extra velocity on each flyby, so they were getting a speed boost as they flew by each one of those planets. Those planets were lined up just right. That number is real. You go to the NASA website on Voyager, and you'll see that exact number quoted. Every 3 years, the thing moves a billion miles further. It's 12 million miles out there right now, three times beyond the distance of Pluto. That's the fastest, longest distance piece of electronics mankind has ever issued. That number is real, Freddie. I don't blame you for being skeptical. That's a big number. KB2VBN, Far Rockaway, K2RIW. You've got it, Freddie.
WS2N, let me give him the URL for that.
Okay, stand by, Freddie, with your pencil. And Paul's going to give you the vital information to really find out what Voyager is doing. And when you go to the NASA website on Voyager, if you have any interest in that kind of technology and that kind of spacecraft, it's a fun thing to read and look at the pictures and whatever. WS2N, K2IW, wait for the beeps and you've got it, Paul.
Very good, Freddie. The website is voyager.jpl@nasa.gov. So it's Voyager, voyager.jpl, that stands for Jet Propulsion Laboratory, .nasa.gov. You go there and you'll see the spacecraft, you know, coming up, and then you have all these different things that you click on at the very top. Click on mission, for instance, and then right below mission you'll see status. Click on that, and it'll give you the distance from Earth, the distance from the sun, speed at which they're going, like you said, 38,000, and then Voyager 2 is going 32,000 miles per hour. But yeah, you gain, like Dick said, you gain all that speed. Just when they went past Jupiter, they picked up 8,000 miles per hour just in that, with one planet alone from that gravity assist. So there you go. Good luck with that, Freddie. Back to you, Dick. WS2N.
KB2, VPN, K2RW. If you need any fills, go ahead and ask for it, Freddy. You got it, Freddy.
I'm going to check that website out and check it out. And I'm going to work tomorrow and tell the kids on the job how fast do they think that space shuttle goes. And then I'm going to let them know where to go get the information in. This is KB2 of VPN.
Now, you called it a space shuttle. It's a spacecraft. The Voyager spacecraft, a deep space probe, and it's out there still talking to us from 12 billion miles away. At the speed of light, it takes up something like 17 or 18 hours for the signal to go one way. That's really out there. At the speed of light, the signal would go, I forget the number, something like 25 times around the Earth in 1 second. This thing, 186,000 miles. Yeah, you can divide the 24,000 mile diameter into 186,000, and you get a whole lot of circles of the Earth in 1 second at the speed of light. So this thing is really far out there. Okay, the next person on our list was, let's see, Ed got his question asked. Kilo Delta 2, Papa Papa Foxtrot. Matt, I think it is. Go right ahead, Matt. K2RIW, the TechNet.
Hey, K2RIW. There's a website, it's called Secure Team 10 on YouTube, and apparently they said about 6 months ago that you know, Voyager went up with the record. I believe they also transmitted the same information through radio, and I heard that, I might be wrong, but 14 years later, supposedly we got an answer next to the station that it was transmitted, you know, kind of like in the form of a crop circle. It's something that you might want to look at, discern, you know, come up with if you think it's right or if it's wrong or if it's fake.